in a negotiation, you have to be prepared to take action. And that's what President Trump is doing.
Trade tensions ease as U.S. negotiations produce new agreements. It's Tuesday, March 27th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Pakistan explains tensions with the United States. Australian Parliament's first Muslim woman speaks out. Asian photographers give a picture of the U.S. South. It's all on today's VOA Asia. South Korea on Monday said it has agreed to further open its auto sector to U.S. vehicles in return for exemption from U.S. steel tariffs. The news came amid talks to amend the U.S.-South Korea Free Trade Agreement. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal on Monday reported the United States has asked China to cut its tariffs on U.S. autos, buy more U.S.-made semiconductors, and give American firms greater access to the Chinese financial sector. The story comes amid growing alarm over a possible trade war after the U.S. announced $60 billion in duties on Chinese goods. On Fox News Sunday, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin cited President Donald Trump, who said he is not afraid of a trade war, but that's not the objective. Rather, it's what he called free and fair reciprocal trade.
I think we're working on a pathway to see if we can reach an agreement as to what fair trade is for them to open up their markets, reduce their tariffs, stop forced technology transfer. These are all the things we want to do. But in a negotiation, you have to be prepared to take action, and that's what President Trump is doing.
China has called on the United States to pull back from the brink and threatened to retaliate by targeting U.S. agriculture, a concern to Iowa Republican Senator Joni Ernst in an appearance on the CBS program Face the Nation.
Roughly 60% of our soybean crop does go to China. So if they start retaliating, we will see significant impact, very detrimental impact.
She called for greater trade as a way to improve the trade imbalance. Many analysts view a trade war as disastrous for everyone, but Gordon Chang, contributor to the publication Daily Beast and author of two books, one called The Coming Collapse of China, tells VOA's Victor Beatty China stands to lose more than the U.S.
We got to remember that China's becoming increasingly dependent on the U.S. So, for instance, in 2016, a stunning 68.0% of China's overall merchandise trade surplus related to sales to the U.S. In 2017, that number increased to 88.8%. Trade surplus countries don't do very well in trade wars. Also, the American economy is so much bigger than China's. Our economy is over $19 trillion. Their economy, they say, is over $12 trillion. But we know that, especially during the 2016-2017, their rate of growth in reality was less than half that reported by the National Bureau of Statistics.
Gordon, China says all options are on the table. They're talking about a 25% tariff on U.S. pork. They also own over $1 trillion in U.S. treasuries. Is that a big concern?
No, it's a tiny concern. You know, they've been talking about what they call the nuclear option, you know, selling U.S. debt to hurt us. They've been talking about it since the middle of 2008. They never do it because it wouldn't work the way the global markets operate. If they sell U.S. debt, they get back dollars because 100% of our obligations are denominated in our own currency. If they're hurting us, they got to go out in the market and buy assets in other currencies, which means those other currencies soar in value, which means that the central banks in those other countries have got to go out and rebalance their currencies. And the only way they can do that is to buy dollars. If the Chinese want to do that, that's fine with me, because we're going to all see that their threat is hollow.
On Sunday, the state-run Global Times said Washington needs to be taught a real lesson and said China should prepare for the worst-case scenario, which is a large-scale trade war with the U.S. It said China is big enough to withstand a trade war, is a key trading partner for many nations, and maintains special influence over issues like North Korea. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on VOAnews.com. Trump's tariffs aimed at China would raise costs in Taiwan. New push sought for Myanmar-India economic links. Pakistan says China standing with it, U.S. constantly receding. expanded coverage of these stories, and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, we invite you to stop by the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A top Pakistani government official says the crisis in relations with the United States stems from Washington's focus on military partnership rather than engaging Pakistan as a democracy and addressing mutual concerns. The story from VOA's Ayaz Ghul is presented to us by VOA Asia's Ira Melman.
In January, U.S. President Donald Trump suspended military assistance to Islamabad on the grounds that the U.S. had received nothing but lies and deceit in return. That withering attack has plunged what was a traditionally roller coaster bilateral relationship to historic lows. In an exclusive interview, the Pakistan Defense Minister, Khurram Dastgir, told VOA that in reaction to the U.S. actions, China has stepped into the void.
We have nearly resolved the energy crisis. We have nearly resolved the terrorism crisis. So now that people of Pakistan and the government of Pakistan, which represents the people, looks back, we see China as standing with us and United States constantly receding.
Beijing has invested billions of dollars in the last 3 years under a massive cooperation deal with Islamabad known as China-Pakistan Economic Cooperation, or CPEC. China is building infrastructure projects and power plants under CPEC. The unprecedented Chinese investment will have added 12,000 additional megawatts of electricity in the national grid by June this year, effectively overcoming the country's once crippling energy crisis. Minister Dastgir called for the U.S. to revisit its Pakistan approach for a stable and productive partnership.
You can't have a country whom would you accuse of being deceitful and simultaneously be major non-NATO ally. So the contradictions in 2018 have become too large.
Dastgir rejected allegations as illogical that Pakistan harbors safe havens and cited the U.S. military's latest assessments that the Taliban controls or contest a large chunk of the Afghan territory. While referring to U.S. military assistance for counterterrorism operations, Dastgir said,
"We are still very serious in maintaining our engagement with the United States. Unfortunately, particularly the Trump administration has chosen to focus on the transactional part of the relationship."
For Ayaz Ghul, I'm Ira Melman, VOA Asia.
The first Muslim woman elected to Australia's federal parliament has spoken of how racism and domestic violence has shaped her career. Egypt-born Anne Alley has released an autobiography called Finding My Place, which details religious bigotry she suffered at a school and violence at the hands of her first husband. We hear more from Phil Mercer, who reports from Sydney.
From Cairo to the Australian capital, Canberra, Finding My Place is the story of abuse, desperation and success. Anne Alley came to Australia from Egypt when she was 2 years old. She details how she was bullied by fellow students at school because of her Arabic heritage, and how she was subjected to abuse and violence by a former husband. Alley, who's 50 years old, went on to forge a successful career as an academic. She became one of the world's leading experts on counter-terrorism and was an advisor to the United Nations. She writes in her newly released autobiography that after a decade as a well-regarded researcher, she was becoming jaded with Australia's political system and its apparent inability to bring about change. She thought the only way to make a difference was to leave her academic career behind and enter politics. In 2016, she was elected by a narrow majority to Australia's federal parliament, where she represents the centre-left Labour opposition. She says that her parliamentary office still receives hate mail and threatening phone calls.
One week in parliament, when somebody decided to call up and tell Anne Alley if she wants to earn the respect of white Australia, then she needs to be quiet. You know, I get a lot of hate mail and I get a lot of hate phone calls, but that one was particularly stinging. And it was particularly stinging because, as I write in the book, I'd spent much of my life trying to be this person that in my mind and in my head, I'm Australian.
According to official statistics, there are about 600,000 Muslims in Australia, which is roughly 2.6% of the total population. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, an Asian perspective of the United States through a camera lens. You're listening to VOA Asia. This news from VOA Asia, crowds gathered around the Meguro River in central Tokyo to mark the arrival of spring by admiring the blooming cherry blossom trees. It's an annual tradition shared with Washington, D.C. over a century ago, as the U.S. Capitol now kicks off its Cherry Blossom Festival. See more on VOA 60 online and at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, two Asian American photographers from New York traveled to the Deep South, the Mississippi Delta, to explore the roots of a seldom mentioned but long-established Chinese community. Their images explore the diverse contributions and experiences of both native-born and immigrant residents. But as VOA's Ramon Taylor and Yi Yuan tell us, young photographers' journey is also a story of self-identity in an environment far from home.
Spoke to Emmanuel at his apartment in Brooklyn Heights and was like, I've always wanted to shoot southern landscapes. Like, what kind of theme can we kind of wrap this around? And so he was like, oh, why not Asians in the deep rural South?
One of the narratives that I was very kind of familiar with was the model minority myth. And that is, you know, that Asian Americans kind of overachieve, and like that's kind of what we're typecast as.
What we were able to see was that a lot of people in the community along the Delta made enormous contributions economically in the region, whether it be opening grocery stores or whether it be being a NASA engineer and creating lunar modules for space missions like Apollo 13. And those are the type of stories that we don't typically hear, and those narratives aren't really present in large urban cities.
What they say to you is like, Qing Qing Chang Chang. I mean, they really spit on my back. Finally, I got in learning that English.
For Steve E. particularly, he went through this harrowing journey of first escaping from China to Hong Kong, and then through Hong Kong, ending up in the Mississippi. And one of the stories that he told us was of just discrimination, just a lot of football guys picking on him and him going to the principal to complain about it, and the principal telling him to man up and basically stand up for himself, which is, I think, yeah, like it's a very American way of thinking, right? Like you stand up for yourself. But Steve was like, those guys were 200, 250 pounds and he was 100 pounds. There was just no way there was any contest. And I think for him, he was kind of fortunate to find art as kind of a way to channel his energy. I think sometimes it's hard when you're not just a minority, but you're like really like 2% of the entire state. They were always kind of in this interesting third position where they were discriminated against, not to the full degree that black people were, but they also were not accorded the privilege that white people had. So it was this kind of interesting tension.
I think in large urban cities, we're very used to seeing people on the street and be like, oh, it's another Asian American person. Cool, like you're not really fazed by it. But I think when you're in the South, especially along the Mississippi Delta and more of those rural pockets, whenever you see another Asian, you're like, wow, that's a, like, our families probably have some sort of tie and we're probably united on some type of front. So I think that level of kind of community, where everyone just really knows each other, is very insane.
I think it's super important to understand that they had entire lives there that were very meaningful, and they were able to serve an even like more underappreciated community back then. And I think it's so important to capture that before, you know, we lose it.
You've been listening to VOA Asia, and while you can hear us many places online, it's always fun to hear us on the radio, like U Radio of Hatta University, FM 101.25, Hatta University in Thailand. Thanks to everyone there who's tuned in today and wherever you happen to be listening. Our thanks always go to director Tracy Carter, the world-famous engineer Zainab Abdel-Rahman, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Byrd on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead.